Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlenka with another episode. And today it has come strongly that I stop skipping from one thing to another, interesting, enlightening as that may be, and begin to re-record the synthesis of yoga in its entirety, which was done some years ago. So, Sri Aurobindo, the synthesis of yoga, all life is yoga. Chapter 1, Life and Yoga. There are two necessities of nature's workings which seem always to intervene in the greater forms of human activity. Whether these belong to our ordinary fields of movement, or seek those exceptional spheres and fulfillments which appear to us high and divine. Every such form tends towards a harmonized complexity and totality, which again breaks apart into various channels of special effort and tendency, only to unite once more in a larger and more puissant synthesis. Secondly, development into forms is an imperative rule of effective manifestation. Yet, all truth and practice too strictly formulated becomes old, loses much, if not all, of its virtue, and must be constantly renovated by fresh streams of the spirit, revivifying the dead or dying, and changing it, if it is to acquire a new life. To be perpetually reborn is the condition of a material immortality. We are in an age full of the throes of travail, which all forms of thought and activity that have in themselves any strong power of utility or any secret virtue of persistence are being subjected to a supreme test and given their opportunity of rebirth. The world today presents the aspect of a huge cauldron of Medea, in which all things are being cast, shredded into pieces, experimented on, combined, recombined, either to perish and provide the scattered material of new forms, or to emerge rejuvenated and changed for a fresh term of existence. Indian yoga, in its essence a special action or formulation of certain great powers of nature, itself specialized, divided, and variously formulated, is potentially one of these dynamic elements of the future life of humanity. The jhana of immemorial ages, preserved by its vitality and truth into our modern times, it is now emerging from the secret schools and ascetic retreats in which it had taken refuge, and is seeking its place in the future sum of living human powers and utilities. But it has first to rediscover itself, bring to the surface the profoundest reason of its being in that general truth and that unceasing aim of nature which it represents, and find by virtue of this new self-knowledge and self-appreciation its own recovered and larger synthesis. Reorganizing itself, it will enter more easily and powerfully. Reorganizing itself, it will enter more easily and powerfully into the reorganized life of the race which its processes claim to lead within into the most secret penetralia and upward to the highest altitudes of existence and personality. In the right view, both of life and of yoga, all life is either consciously or subconsciously a yoga. We mean by this term a methodized effort towards self-perfection by the expression of the secret potentialities latent in the being, and highest condition of victory in that effort, a union of the human individual with the universal and transcendent existence we see partially expressed in man and in the cosmos. But all life, when we look behind its appearances, is a vast yoga of nature who attempts, in the conscious and the subconscious, to realize her perfection in an ever-increasing expression of her yet unrealized potentialities, and to unite herself with her own divine reality. In man, her thinker, she for the first time upon this earth devises self-conscious means and willed arrangements of activity by which this great purpose may be more swiftly and puissantly attained. Yoga, as Swami Vivekananda has said, may be regarded as a means of compressing one's evolution into a single life or a few years or even a few months of bodily existence. A given system of yoga, then, can be no more than a selection or a compression into narrower but more energetic forms of intensity of the general methods which are already being used loosely, largely, in a leisurely movement with a profuser apparent waste of material and energy, but with a more complete combination by the Great Mother in her vast upward labor. It is this view of yoga that can alone form the basis for a sound and rational synthesis of yogic methods. For then yoga ceases to appear something mystic and abnormal, which has no relation to the ordinary processes of the world energy or the purpose she keeps in view in her two great movements of subjective and objective self-fulfillment. It reveals itself rather as an intense and exceptional use of powers that she has already manifested or is progressively organizing in her less exalted but more general operations. Yogic methods have something of the same relation to the customary psychological workings of man as has the scientific handling of the force of electricity or of steam to their normal operations in nature. And they, too, like the operations of science, are formed upon a knowledge developed and confirmed by regular experiment, practical analysis, and constant result. All Raja Yoga, for instance, depends on this perception and experience that our inner elements, combinations, functions, forces, can be separated or dissolved, can be new combined and set to novel and formerly impossible workings, or can be transformed and resolved into a new general synthesis by fixed internal processes. Hatha Yoga similarly depends on this perception and experience that the vital forces and functions to which our life is normally subjected and whose ordinary operations seem set and indispensable can be mastered and the operations changed or suspended with results that would otherwise be impossible. And that seems miraculous to those who have not seized the rationale of their process. And if in some other of its forms this character of yoga is less apparent, because they are more intuitive and less mechanical, nearer, like the yoga of devotion, to a supernal ecstasy, or, like the yoga of knowledge, to a supernal infinity of consciousness and being. Yet they too start from the use of some principal faculty in us by ways and for ends not contemplated in its everyday spontaneous workings. All methods, grouped under the common name of yoga, are special psychological processes founded on a fixed truth of nature and developing out of normal functions, powers, and results, which were always latent, but which her ordinary movements do not easily or do not often manifest. But, as in physical knowledge, the multiplication of scientific processes has its disadvantages, as that tends, for instance, to develop a victorious artificiality which overwhelms our natural human life under a load of machinery, and to purchase certain forms of freedom and mastery at the price of an increased servitude. So, the preoccupation with yogic processes and their exceptional results may have its disadvantages and losses. The yogin tends to draw away from the common existence, lose its hold upon it. He tends to purchase wealth of spirit by an impoverishment of his human activities, inner freedom by outer death. If he gains God, he loses life, or if he turns his efforts outward to conquer life, he is in danger of losing God. Therefore, we see in India that a sharp incompatibility has been created between life in the world and spiritual growth and perfection. And although the tradition and ideal of a victorious harmony between the inner attraction and the outer demand remains, it is little, or else very imperfectly, exemplified. In fact, when a man turns his vision and energy inward and enters onto the path of yoga, he is popularly supposed to be lost inevitably to the great stream of our collective existence and the secular effort of humanity. So strongly has the idea prevailed, so much has it been emphasized by prevalent philosophies and religions, that to escape from life is now commonly considered is not only the necessary condition, but the general object of yoga. No synthesis of yoga can be satisfying which does not, in its aim, reunite God and nature in a liberated and perfected human life, or in its method, not only permit but favor the harmony of our inner and outer activities and experiences in the divine consummation of both. For man is precisely that term and symbol of a higher existence, descended into the material world, in which it is possible for the lower to transfigure itself and put on the nature of the higher, and the higher to reveal itself in the forms of the lower. To avoid the life which is given him for the realization of that possibility can never be either the indispensable condition or the whole and ultimate object of his supreme endeavor or of his most powerful means of self-fulfillment. It can only be a temporary necessity under certain conditions or a specialized extreme effort imposed on the individual so as to prepare a greater general possibility for the race. The true and full object and utility of yoga can only be accomplished when the conscious yoga in man becomes, like the subconscious yoga in nature, outwardly conterminous with life itself, and we can once more, looking out both on the path and the achievement, say, in a more perfect and luminous sense, all life is yoga. End of chapter 1, part 1. To be continued next time with the next episode. Marlenka signing off for now, hoping that this synthesis of yoga by Sri Aurobindo is just what you need to hear today. Bye for now.
This is Oroville Radio, Voices from the City of Dome.